Loneliness is a part of the human condition, just like love, hate, sadness, joy, and regret. When it's tempered by the right amount of social interaction, loneliness can feel like a fleeting mood, a moment of gloomy internal weather that passes like a rain shower and that you can shake off in a matter of hours. But when loneliness becomes extended, when it is both emotional and social, when it isolates, it becomes a health risk. Untreated, loneliness leads to a 26% increased risk of mortality. It is as bad for us, the research says, as smoking 15 cigarettes a day. Now, we ban smoking, but we can't do the same with loneliness. You can't legislate against it. It creeps into the spaces and crevices of our lives even more perniciously and obstinately than smoke. What we can do to dissipate the toxic fumes of loneliness is talk about it, bring it out into the open, and dissipate it with fresh air and fresh ideas. And that's what we're going to try and do this evening.
I think loneliness is probably something that we really have very little understanding of the depth which persists in our society. I think in today's cities particularly, it's very, very easy to be anonymous. And that anonymity can very often lead to loneliness. And particularly, I think we see this a lot in men.
Do we appreciate the impacts of loneliness? I would say probably not to the full extent. Coming from my background working with newly arrived migrants and refugees in Australia, we see sometimes the real impacts of social isolation and the difficulties that those people face when they are settling into a new home. And you do see really significant mental health issues and things like that. So I think a lot more work needs to be done to really appreciate just what loneliness is and the toll that it takes.
I think there's a lot of information out there and people are talking about it. I think there's heaps more to discover because the idea that you can be surrounded by people and in relationships and still experience loneliness that is damaging and threatening to your mental health and mental well-being and might eventually have harmful impacts for yourself and those relationships, we need to know more about that one.
I think we need to be aware of it, particularly for the young ones, who are always involved in computers and their life online rather than in real life. And yeah, if we can be mindful of the amount of anxiety and depression and everything else in the young ones due to that isolation.
Well, good evening, everybody. So I'm Andrew Bickerdike. I'm the CEO of Relationships Australia Victoria and the board chair of Relationships Australia National. I'd also like to acknowledge the traditional custodians of the land on which we meet this evening and pay my respects to the Aboriginal people here tonight and their elders past, present and emerging. So I'd like to welcome you all here to this event to help us celebrate our 70th anniversary, and I'd particularly like to welcome our distinguished guests, including the Honourable Michelle Landry, MP, Assistant Minister for Children and Families, other Commonwealth and State Parliamentary members, our panellist, Caroline Baum, Tegan Cruis, Penny Esley, Elizabeth Shaw, and Hugh Mackay, who I think is coming in via technology on video. If Hugh Mackay is coming in first on video, I'm introducing Hugh Mackay coming in first on video.
Yes. I'm very sorry I couldn't join you in person to celebrate the 70th anniversary of Relationships Australia and to participate with the other panellists in this discussion. I think the deepest truth about human beings also happens to be the sweetest truth about us and the noblest truth about us, and that is that we are by nature social beings. We absolutely need each other. We depend utterly on neighbourhoods, communities, families, groups of all kinds to nurture us, to protect us, and even to give us a sense of our own identity. If you want to know who you are, you look into the faces of the people who love you, or the people you work with, or the people in your neighbourhood, the people who'll put up with you, and most particularly the people who need you. That's who you are. That's why, for example, in our criminal justice system, the harshest punishment we can think of is solitary confinement. Because for herd animals like us, the bitterest punishment is to be cut off from the herd, which doesn't mean that we don't need and enjoy periods of isolation. We all need time on our own. But what we need that time for is to replenish our resources for the very challenging task of belonging to a social species. Now, if you bear that in mind and think about contemporary Australia, it's very clear what our major social problem has become. We're more socially fragmented than we've ever been. Our households are shrinking. Every fourth household, and it will very soon be every third household, contains just one person. That's the fastest growing household type in Australia. That doesn't mean that every third or fourth household contains a lonely person, but it does mean that in every third or fourth household around Australia, the risk of loneliness and a sense of social isolation is greatly increased. Between 35 and 40% of contemporary marriages are ending in divorce. That's a very fragmenting phenomenon, of course, and not just for the couples that are splitting and for their families and their friendship groups, but for any kids. And while we're talking about kids, another factor to mention on this list of contributors to our social fragmentation is the falling birth rate. Any parent knows that if you move into a new neighbourhood, it's usually the kids who act as a sort of social lubricant. They get to know the other kids, and gradually the families get to know each other. So when we're experiencing the lowest birth rate in our history, we're producing, relative to total population, the smallest generation of children we've ever produced. That means that that social lubricant is in shorter supply, and we have to compensate. We are compensating, of course, by while the birth rate crashes, the rate of pet ownership is going through the roof. I recently met a dog called Ian, and I thought that was a bit of a funny name for a dog, but I certainly realised that Ian was a child substitute. But what about our increased busyness? We're working longer hours. People who work in occupations where they're accessible via information technology say that in a way they're never away from work. There are always emails and text messages and other things to be attended to. And when we're busier, of course, we have much less time and much less energy available for the business of nurturing the local neighbourhood. So our busyness tends to isolate us from each other, as of course does our almost addictive attachment to our IT devices. They seem to be connecting us, but it's a paradox because while they're connecting us, they're also making it easier than ever for us to stay apart from each other. And there is a huge qualitative difference between face-to-face communication between humans who are present to each other and communication, or we should really just call it data transfer, that happens via information technology. So you put all of those things together, add to that our increasing mobility. We're moving house on average once every 6 years, and of course we're a drive-in, drive-out society. We tend to go everywhere by car, footpath traffic falls away. All of those things contribute to more sense of isolation, less sense of belonging to stable and cohesive neighbourhoods. Now, in the light of what I was saying about the nature of our species, think about what is likely to happen. Pretty obviously, what you would expect is that greater social fragmentation would lead to more anxiety, more mental disturbance, more restlessness, perhaps even more depression. And that, of course, is precisely what's happened, not only here, but around most Western societies that we'd compare ourselves with. There clearly is something we can do about this. We are not simply the hapless victims of all these things I've been describing. In fact, we're active participants in them. We make these social changes happen. So what could we do about it? Well, there'll be many suggestions, I'm sure, coming from the panelists here. But let me just say, I think the critical word that could transform the whole thing, the critical word that would capture the strategy that's going to solve the problem of the link between social fragmentation and high anxiety is the word compassion. We're going to have to learn that for human communities to thrive and prosper, or perhaps even to survive, we have to engage, we have to connect. All that means in practical terms is you'd never pass someone on the footpath and fail to smile and say hello. You'd never find yourself saying, as so many people in our major cities now do say, we don't know our neighbours. You'd go and knock on the door and make sure you do know them. You'd never be able to say, gosh, someone in our street died in their house and no one knew for 2 weeks. You wouldn't allow that to happen because you'd be the kind of person who, well, you'd know to call in occasionally and make sure everything's okay. Can I give you a hand with your shopping or put the bin out or anything? It's not rocket science. It's not even very hard. It's just a matter of making the commitment to the idea that every human encounter will be handled kindly and that I'll seize every opportunity available to me to join, acquire a community garden, a current affairs discussion, anything that will connect me with the local neighbourhood, not just because it'll be good for me. Nothing gets my anxiety level down like the exercise of compassion, but also because I know it'll be good for the community. The only way to maintain the health of the community is to connect, to participate, to engage, and above all, to look out for the hazard of social isolation.
Well, if we all had Hugh Mackay as our neighbour, we wouldn't be having to tackle the problem. And if you have not read his latest book, Australia Reimagined, Towards a More Compassionate, Less Anxious Society, go and grab a copy tomorrow. It's essential, inspiring reading. In 1973, eminent American sociologist Robert Weiss pointed out that loneliness was more often commented on by songwriters than social scientists. So, to quote Elvis, let me ask you, are you lonesome tonight? Now, you've all got your programs, and those programs have got professional bios in them of our three distinguished panelists. But what those bios don't tell you is about their own personal experience of loneliness. For Elizabeth Shaw, who's sitting in the middle, it was the disruption of being sent to a new school at the age of 7, while her parents found a new home in another state. An experience she found traumatic, except that it made her attuned to how this feels for others, a precious insight that she brings to her work at the coalface of counseling. For Tegan Cruis on my left, it came from moving around to further her career, ironically researching loneliness, which gave her first-hand experience of what it feels like to lose your networks and how bereft and unmoored you feel without them, even when you have great colleagues and a partner. And for Penny Elsley on the far end of the panel, it was the shock of being a first-time mother when she felt isolated by a lack of support in her own neighborhood. So I hope that's given you a sort of a very different sort of perception of our three panelists this evening. I'm going to start by asking you, Elizabeth, to kick off and give us, if you like, a little bit of a profile of loneliness today in terms of emotional loneliness. We know that there are two types of loneliness that come up in all the research: emotional loneliness, social loneliness. So I wonder if you could give us a little bit of a sort of thumbnail of what you know about emotional loneliness.
Well, it's often thought that the antidote to loneliness would be to find a partner, and if you're able to do that, you sort of home and hosed. But there's plenty of research that talks about emotional and relational loneliness, where people are in fact perhaps with an intimate partner or quite well connected and feeling very alone. And in fact, considerable research that says if your partner is lonely, then you can catch it from them, like a sort of emotional contagion. And that image came to mind when I was thinking about this, about the particular poignancy or the pain of being with someone that you might expect to meet at least some of your needs or to care about you or want to connect with you, and you can't reach them and they can't reach you. And that's, you know, it's quite excruciating in its own way.
What are the factors like gender and age? How does loneliness kind of escalate in older age? And how do the sexes deal with it differently?
Well, it certainly can escalate in later life because a lot of the things that might have filled in your time or the compensations that you found through work or friends change over time. Certainly, I remember reading in one study that talked about the emotions that run hot for younger couples, such as, you know, the anger and resentment and couples that can rail against each other when there's disappointments, and talking about how in later in life, when one hopefully becomes more emotionally regulated, these sorts of experiences cool into loneliness. Mm-hmm. That instead of railing against what happens in the relationship, there's a cooling off, which becomes a distancing, which I thought was very evocative. But certainly the gender research is fairly equivocal in that sometimes there's talk about there not being such great gender differences, but I think people experience it differently, where women can experience more loss from the relationship. Men later in life can feel more preoccupied with the loneliness that comes from friends that they don't have or friends that they don't see.
What's the economic sort of profile here? I'm just wondering, you know, can you buy your way out of loneliness if you're sort of better off in terms of the socioeconomic scale? Mm-hmm. What are the differences there?
I think it's all about the community that you're around. And in the end, there can be people in very large houses, very, very alone, no one on the street, people driving in. Hugh talks about this, about people driving into their triple carport and going into the house through the garage, and they're not on the street and they don't know their neighbours and they have high walls. I think that sense of isolation can be very great, perhaps compared to someone who's living in a caravan park, who in fact might have much greater opportunity to run into people, but who also can feel very, very isolated.
Tegan, I mentioned before that, you know, we talk about these two different kinds of loneliness, emotional loneliness, social loneliness. What is social loneliness?
Yeah, I think when we're talking about loneliness, often we are talking about community, right? We're talking about our sense of being part of something meaningful, of being part of something that we care deeply about. And indeed, we've run some studies where we've compared our interpersonal relationships to our more social community relationships, our sense of belonging to communities. And we find that actually it's the community relationships that often predict more in terms of health outcomes. So I think they're both important, but perhaps we need to spend some more time talking about community and belonging, because I think it does sometimes get less attention than it deserves.
So do you think, for example, today that maybe it's harder to find that sort of sense of belonging without the traditional props of class and religion? You know, church is not just about worship and faith. It is about community. It is about catching up with people after the service for a cup of tea. So are we struggling because we've chucked too many things out and we haven't replaced them with anything?
Yeah, I think that's a nice way of putting it in a way. I think of a great example of that would be my grandmother. I mean, she was very committed to the Methodist Church, and they spent their whole lives really engaged in activities related to that church. She, whether it was caring for members of the church in their older age, whether it was my grandfather playing the organ at the Sunday service and putting on the morning teas and the wakes, and just their whole life was through caring through the church. And I think that they both gave a lot through that, but they also got a lot mm-hmm. from that. And there's been some research on this, and they show that religious identity is good for our health. And I think that's got as much to do with the identity that it does to do with the religion, because, yeah, perhaps we don't have in our lives group memberships that are as important and as meaningful for everyone as those used to be.
Penny, I'd like your response to that, and I'd like you to respond to that partly by telling us the solution, in a way, that you've created, which is so inspiring and which in a way, answers so many of the things that Tegan and Elizabeth have talked about.
Thanks, Caroline. Yeah, I think, I mean, it's so important what we're talking about here tonight, because really what's underneath every social issue is disconnection. And what we've seen through the Welcome Dinner Project is very much that the tiniest spark of connection can have an enormous effect. For those of you who don't know about the Welcome Dinner Project, it came about from what we were hearing from the community. And in particular, I was at a lunch one day and I heard from some women who I was sitting next to who were from South Sudan, who said to me that they'd been here for 5 years and no Australian people had invited them to their home. And the other lady on the other side of me said, well, I've been here for 10 years and I've never been to an Australian home either, but I'd love to go. And that same afternoon, a couple of my colleagues came up and asked if I've introduced them to someone who'd come here as a migrant or a refugee, because they'd been looking for about 10 years to welcome people who are new, but just didn't know where to go to find these people. All, you know, they're worried they might do something culturally inappropriate. So, you know, here I was in Sydney, in one of the most culturally diverse cities in the world, and people were not finding a way to connect, even when they wanted to. And so, you know, a few weeks later, there was this dinner that I held in my home and invited people who were new to Australia and some people who were familiar to me. And something arose that night that sparked what is now a social movement. We've had over 500 of these dinners around Australia and in a few other countries now as well. And from that very first time when we shared this meal with strangers, what I saw was people's eyes shining. You know, there was something that came from this simplicity of sharing food. And it's in our DNA, right? At the basis of every culture is hospitality. And what I came up with, I guess, is in the simplicity of this model was that we hold these dinners in our homes, that the resources are there in our fingertips, and that everyone brings something to share. So whether you're on a six-figure income or you just arrived here yesterday, you bring something and everybody tells a story about their dish and you're heard. And for some people, you're heard for the first time. These very subtle things that happen throughout this ritual awaken something in all of us. And what surprised us through this emergence of this project is that as much as we think we were doing this to help the people who are new, it's helping everybody. And that we hear the same comments from local people that we hear from the new arrivals, and that is that I felt lonely here. And often people say, until tonight. And for many people, international students are included in our newcomers in these dinners, and most of them say it's the first time I've been invited anywhere. And we know there's been some research. I heard at a conference, and I wish I could find the specifics of it, but I remember it was over 90% of these international students go home never having been to an Australian home. And these are simple things that we can do. We have those resources, and what was missing was, a sense of safety. And not just physical safety, because these are people who are willing to meet each other, but a sense of cultural safety and emotional safety. And so what's quite unique about this model that we developed is that they're facilitated dinners. And what's even more unique is that our facilitators are not people who you'd think would normally come and facilitate something. These are people at the grassroots who are doing our trainings and coming to facilitate these dinners together.
Having been to one of these dinners, I have to say, I can recommend them. They're a really heartwarming experience. Elizabeth, I want to ask you about something that I thought about during the week in relation to this conversation. It seemed to me that one of the big problems with loneliness that we have as a society is that we associate shame with admitting loneliness. It's as if by saying that you are lonely, you are admitting failure, you are admitting that you are some kind of misfit. So what can we do about removing the stigma, if you agree with me that there is a stigma? And do you think that loneliness requires something which is an adjunct to a campaign like
are you okay? Or how do you see the solution in those terms?
Well, certainly, you know, I've read about quite a lot of research on sort of teens to 25s who feel particularly lonely on a Saturday night, for example. And I think what that tells us is loneliness is also socially constructed, and that in terms of cross-cultural studies, it's noted that that can be more palpable in Western societies where everything is centred on whether you've actually been able to attract anybody and hold on to them. Whereas in comparisons with collectivist cultures, so perhaps some Asian communities, I've read some about Korean communities, for example, where family, you're meant to have more of your needs met for intimacy through family, then the partner slots into that. So that sense of loneliness is more diffuse and the role the partner's meant to play is quite different. So for me, trying to do something about that in terms of how we're bringing up children is to try and notice with them that that may be something that's a social norm and not something that we should take as an absolute truth.
Mm. Yeah. Tegan, what happens when you introduce intergenerational actions in terms of social loneliness? Because we're hearing a lot in the aged care space, which has obviously been in the headlines all week, about how beneficial it is to mix up aged care with preschool, for example, that, you know, it gives a great deal of joy and pleasure to the older generation to be in contact with younger generations. So what are you seeing?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. We've been doing a bit of work around, I guess, loneliness in young people, which you mentioned, and I think sometimes that's underestimated. We talk about older people experiencing loneliness, and that's honestly where most of the research has been done, mm-hmm. is in older people. But actually, when you look at the distribution in Australia and other countries, you see a real peak in 15 to 25-year-olds as well. And so in some ways, it does make sense to draw those links across the generations, because we know that people are experiencing it at different times in life. And I think that also speaks to the point, which is kind of another point I wanted to make, that so much of what causes loneliness is not really about, you know, if you like, individual loss or deficits. Like, that's where stigma comes from, right? Is this idea that I've done something wrong or there's something wrong with me. But it comes from our life experiences. It comes from things like life transitions. And the times when people experience loneliness is moving to a new school, moving to a new city, becoming a mum, retiring. These changes we go through in our lives are often the major trigger for a loss of connectedness. But they can also be opportunities to build new connectedness. And I think that's an opportunity we should be kind of training people up to take advantage of as well.
Are you seeing in the welcome dinners, Penny, that intergenerational connection is part of the joy of what happens?
Absolutely. And I think to some level of surprise as well. You know, we try to mix up the ages as much as possible, as well as the different cultures. And we have about 20 people on average at each dinner. And one of the very first dinners, one of the international students came up to me afterwards and she said, when I walked up to the door and the man who was hosting was there waiting for me, she said, it felt like my own father was there to greet me at the door and I didn't feel homesick anymore. This, to me, just ignited that sense of how important it is to bring the different generations together, because for so many of us, we don't have our families around, and we don't live in that time where, you know, we have the extended family around us anymore, and we've lost the village in many ways.
Mm. Mm. Now, another complicating factor in all of this, Elizabeth, of course, is cognitive decline. And the research shows that I think 31% of the general public has experienced loneliness at one time, but that figure shoots up to 57% of people with dementia experience some form of isolation or loneliness. And we were talking in the car on the way here about our experience of this personally in terms of our own families. And I was just wondering what your thoughts are about what we can do to address the issue of loneliness in relation to dementia, cognitive decline?
Look, I think this is particularly challenging because we don't like people that are difficult. We don't like people who are unpleasant. And we're very intolerant of this, and probably the busier we are, the less tolerant we are. And you'll often see people arguing with their, you know, relatives about, no, that's not how it happened, and as if it matters, really. And so you could have a lovely conversation about something that never happened at all, never will happen, and still have a lovely visit.
What do you think is the correlation between boredom and loneliness? Because it strikes me when I've visited aged care facilities, particularly, you know, both cognitive decline, non-cognitive decline wings, that people often seem very, very bored. Is boredom an indicator of loneliness? Is there a relationship between the two?
Well, absolutely. And I think there is an assumption for older people that they're in some sort of reverie, you know, that we can pretend there's some, you know, lovely sort of reflection going on, when in fact the person might be bored witless and not able to communicate that in some way. And I think certainly how you manage with this sort of patient-centred care, which is really often a lot of rhetoric, and still run an institution, is very difficult. And I know for my own mother, in the music sessions that they had, she was furious that they kept having the wrong war represented. She said, you know, none of us were here in World War One. Why do we have to be singing the songs from that era? And she probably would have been singing Pharrell Williams, frankly. But, you know, I think we sort of, you know, I often thought to myself, you know, what will we all tolerate, you know, when we get there, which is getting sort of horribly close. You know, and I just think it won't be tolerable to be treated like that, and nor should it be tolerable now.
Right.
Can I just add to that? So, Carolyn, just because we've run some studies in care homes looking at some of these questions, right? And I think so much of where our sense of purpose comes from is our groups, right? And our identities. And sometimes that gets slowly stripped away from us as we get older, right? Our capacity to contribute is no longer supported within our communities. And so I'm thinking of one intervention we ran in particular where we had older people in these homes join a design team to actually develop the how the central areas of the home would be renovated. And the control home, the renovation was designed and conducted by the staff. And we saw improved cognitive health as well as improved mental health when people were actually able to come together into a group and design that experience themselves. And he says there's a number of things going on there around purpose and control, but also togetherness, that a simple intervention like that can actually achieve. And I think, so sometimes these things don't have to cost a lot of money or be major changes, but it is just about empowerment and connectedness.
Well, there's so many things that you said there that really resonate. Now, I get a sense from a lot of the conversations I've had with Hugh around his new book and around some of the things that he said today, that he's very ambivalent about technology. And he does think that technology is partly responsible for the fragmentation that he talks about. But I think that there are a lot of great things that technology can do to connect people who feel isolated and lonely. And I was wondering whether you agree and whether you've got any examples of things like that.
Yeah, I strongly agree. And I think sometimes there are definitely downsides to technology. And I think particularly some tech companies have invested a lot of money in figuring out how to distract people and keep them engaged in things that aren't all that helpful. But that's very different from finding your people and having a community and a sense of connection online. And I think particularly in regional and rural areas where you might not be able to find your people on your street, people with whom you have something in common or a sense of connection, there are very powerful online tools to connect people. But that's not the same as just having a Facebook friend.
No. So give me an example then of an app that you think works particularly well in terms of connecting people.
Yeah, so
helping you find your tribe.
Yeah, so one I've discovered recently, which I think is amazingly successful and active, even in Australia, even though it wasn't developed here, is called Meetup.com. And this is an app and a website where you can basically find people in your area who want to get together around a whole variety of different things.
Just for dating.
No, which is important. there are people on there who have got, you know, looking for singles under 30, but that's a minority. Most are looking for instance, professional development activities in their particular area professionally. Or the majority are around activity groups. So people who are looking to go hiking this Saturday, people who are looking for a group of people to play board games with. So these are, you know, based around your interests, your area, and everyone going is equally awkward and looking to make friends, which I think is very reassuring.
It is. Penny, I was just wondering, how much of a role does food play in the equation of the welcome dinner? It's one thing to be invited into someone's home and the symbolism of crossing that threshold and the hospitality. What about the actual food?
Oh, totally. And I think there's just something about the smells and the chewing the food and the clinking of the glasses or whatever it is that creates an atmosphere. And I mean, no matter what welcome dinner you walk into, and I, you know, travel the country going to different welcome dinners, and they're all so different, different spaces and different mixes of people, there's something that always feels the same. And part of it is, you know, that atmospheric part of it and the excitement of strangers being in a room together.
How do you get around the cultural sensitivities that some people have around what they eat and what they don't eat, for example? How do you do that?
We do it because we ask people to be open. The whole thing that's so fascinating about this project is that there is a deep curiosity and fascination with each other's cultures and with our food. I mean, look at all the different cultural restaurants that we have popping up everywhere and have for a long time in this country. And I think, you know, we actually use a theory behind the design of this two-hour process of the welcome dinner, and it's called Theory U. And many of you may be familiar with Otto Scharmer's work. It's come out at MIT University. And he basically has created this framework where we can go on a journey together to create transformation and to create something that is not a forced outcome, but an outcome that comes from going on a journey together of openness. And he says three things, and I know Hugh talked about compassion, but there's actually three C's. And the first one is curiosity, because that's what sparks us to move ourselves in and to open our mind. And the next one, once we open our mind and start listening to each other, then we get that compassion. We get the empathy coming up. And from that, the biggest outcome we're finding from these 10,000 people who participated so far is the courage. And that courage can't be underestimated, because with that courage then comes all sorts of things that we can then go and do that we were never going to do before.
I wanted to ask you, Elizabeth, Britain has been very active in the loneliness space, and I'm sure most of you would know that Britain is the first country in the world to have appointed a minister for loneliness, largely in memory of the work that Jo Cox did in this field before she was tragically murdered. And I'm just wondering whether you think that loneliness is the kind of crisis that requires that kind of action, whether you think a minister for loneliness is a good idea, or whether, in fact, on the contrary, we're forgetting that many of the solutions to the problem are, in fact, as simple as picking up the phone, ringing someone, knocking on a door.
Well, I don't know if it'll get traction calling it a crisis, because I think the nature of it is you can't get momentum that way. I think it's a symbol, though. I think what's important is sometimes the symbol has got us talking about it in Australia, and it got some press and it got some interest. And I think people are curious, but then I think it's everybody probably doing their bit. You know, and I think movements such as Relationships Australia has Neighbour Day, those sort of things again, like Are You OK Day, those are both symbolic and practical ways to get conversations happening.
We've come to the end of this part of the evening and celebration of Relationships Australia's birthday. Will you please join me in thanking the panel? I would like to urge you all to sign up for a welcome dinner. I would like to wish Relationships Australia a very happy birthday, and I would like to call Andrew back to the stage.
Thank you, Caroline. Thank you, panel. What a wonderful conversation. What a rich conversation. Okay, so now, just to talk about the research we're undertaking. So we're undertaking some research to increase our understanding of loneliness. We're using the data from the Household Income and Labour Dynamics of Australia survey. To many of you, you may not know what that is, but it's called the HILDA survey, and it's a huge bank of data that's been collected and continues to be collected over time. And this data will allow us to report on the prevalence and persistence of loneliness for vulnerable Australians. And the data that we use to do this has been generously provided to us by the Commonwealth Department of Social Services. And I'd now like to call upon the Assistant Minister for Social Services, the Honourable Michelle Landry, MP, to launch this research.